My dad had to be sheriff in Kitson County, moved into the jail. Back in the cell block area, there was one cell block for prisoners, and this other one was locked up.
Good afternoon, members and those in attendance. This is the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, Wednesday, April 1st. It's about 7 minutes after 1 o'clock. Members, we're going to start today with Senate File 1116. Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're starting to assemble our annual game and fish bill. And so what we'll do is the vehicle for that will be the agency proposals on the game and fish arena. And so Mr. Bogus will go through those provisions, discuss that, play it over. We'll go through the other bills as well. And then Monday or Tuesday, we will pass the whole game and fish bill out. Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Bogus, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. Just walking through the bill, Section 1 of the bill relates to some legislation from last year that required that we adjust fees for aquatic farms so that aquaculture licensing and enforcement would be self-sustaining. In other words, currently our cost of administering aquaculture licensing is higher than the revenue that we get from those licenses. What we're asking for in this bill is on lines 2.5 to 2.8, and that is that we could set those fees without going through the full Chapter 14 rulemaking process. That's a very lengthy and expensive type of a process to go through. We've gotten some pretty clear direction from the legislature on setting these fees to recover the costs. And you'll also see this provision, similar provision, in some other sections of the bill. Section 2 relates to the same issue, and then also later on in Section 18, where we have aquaculture licensing provisions in Chapter 17, which these first two sections are dealing with, which are the ag chapters, and then also in Chapter 97C, which are the fisheries chapters. So we'll see this same issue a little bit later in the bill. Moving on to
Mr. Bogus, do we have an idea where those fees are headed as far as costs?
Mr. Chair, we haven't worked out all the details on that yet. We do have some preliminary information. We're recovering a little bit more than half the cost right now. These licenses, the base license fee right now is $210, regardless of how many wetlands or how many wetland acres are licensed. And there's also a requirement that we index these fees to the acreage of wetlands that are licensed. So there will be some adjustment to that $210 base fee of maybe 10 or 15% increase. And then the remainder of the, 40% or so of the additional fees that we need to make up would be accomplished through some kind of a fee per acre or fee per wetland. And we certainly would be prepared to talk about that in more detail when this bill gets to a finance committee.
Thank you.
Moving on to Section 3, and there's several sections here that relate to
Mr. Bogus, I'm going to interrupt you one more time. Senator Ingebretson, did you have something related to that?
To that point, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just so this is going to offset the cost. It's not going to have any additional revenue. It's just going to offset your cost. The fees.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, it will just offset our costs of administering and enforcing these licenses.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Bogus.
Section 3 and then several other sections in sequence here relate to broadening out the issuance of refunds for registrations. Under current law, if the commissioner or deputy registrar makes an error, we can issue a refund. This would allow it, even if the error is made by the applicant, if it's done within 60 days. And Section 3 relates to registrations for off-highway motorcycles. Section 4 relates to off-road vehicles, the same issue. Section 5 to snowmobiles. Section 6 ATVs. Section 7 watercraft. And in all those, we're just expanding the authorization to issue refunds if there's a mistake made by the applicant, as long as they come within 60 days and seek that refund.
Mr. Bogus, I hate to keep interrupting you, but I'm just curious why these are in our game and fish bill. Is that typical or usual? Or,
Mr. Chair, the DNR's licensing unit resides in the Division of Fish and Wildlife now, and this does relate to things that aren't really game and fish necessarily, but our licensing section primarily does game and fish licenses, but they also do these registrations, so we brought this forward in this bill.
Typically, might we see them in other places, though, or?
Mr. Chair, it could be in some. If there were some kind of a off-road vehicle, watercraft-type bill, they would certainly fit in that type of a bill.
Mm-hmm. Or your technical bill?
Or the technical bill, yes. We do have another bill, and I know there's some things that are currently in here that have been moved into the other kind of policy-level bill that's Senate File 1110 that Senator Chaudhry also is carrying. And I guess it doesn't matter to us which vehicle they end up in, no pun intended.
Senator Chaudhry, did you want to weigh in on that?
We can do that because the other bill has to go to finance anyway. As long as these provisions need no other committee, we could attempt to amend them on in finance.
Just curious. Thank you, Mr. Bogus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Continuing on then on page 4, section 8, this is a pretty technical change that relates to a change later on in the bill in Section 23 that I'll just talk about quickly now. And that is that there's a provision in Section 23 to prohibit the taking, possession, or transportation of live coyotes. We've been hearing from some other states that there's getting to be quite a market in live coyotes right now. There's no regulation of that in Minnesota. There's the potential for that to be moving diseases around the country. And so we've got later on a restriction on taking, possessing, transporting live coyotes. The change here in Section 8 is just to make it clear that later restriction does not change the classification of coyotes to a protected animal. Currently, they're an unprotected animal. But once there's any protection other than what's listed in this section of law, then they would become a protected species if we didn't have this provision in here. So that's why this is in here at this time.
Mr. Chairman.
Section 9.
Senator Dill?
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question about that part about the coyotes? Mr. Bogus, to explain a little further why we got this provision in here. You said that there's a market for coyotes and there's a lot of transport of coyotes right now. So what's the problem?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, it's the taking them alive and then shipping them around the country that we're primarily worried about. There's a lot of the market for this is in hound running pens, as they're called, in mostly the southeastern United States, but there are some in Iowa, Illinois, Missouri.
Mr. Bogus, there's a pretty large hound training facility near Little Falls, isn't there, where they use live coyotes to train their trail hounds?
Mr. Chair, we are finding out as we bring this forward that there are some significant facilities in Minnesota that are using live coyotes, and there are a few things that I can point out as we go through the bill where, these are department provisions that we're bringing forward, but we'd like to work with the author and the committee to maybe make some changes. On this one, we're thinking that our primary concern is the exporting or importing of live coyotes into or out of Minnesota. That's where the real threat of moving diseases. There have been some problems in the southeastern United States where they brought in coyotes from the southwest that in an area where rabies is endemic in coyotes, and it's not endemic most parts of the country in coyotes. And so, it's just those types of wildlife disease issues that we're primarily concerned about.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm puzzled if coyotes aren't a protected animal, why you are thinking that and adding this provision under the definition of protected wild animals, that somehow that would be recognized.
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, the definition of protected wild animals doesn't list those animals. It just says that it lists categories there, and then it says, and wild animals that are protected by a restriction in the time or manner of taking, other than a restriction in the use of artificial lights, poison, or motor vehicles, which are allowed under some circumstances for unprotected animals. So if we restricted the time or manner of taking to prohibit the taking of a live coyote and didn't add that language on line 4.10, then they would become a protected wild animal under this definition. And we didn't, we thought that wasn't our intent. We don't need to do that, and there's controversy associated with classifying them as a protected wild animal. So we were just trying to make it clear that this does not classify them as a protected species.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Boga, supposing the Minnesota Zoo or the Como Park Zoo says we'd like to buy a couple coyotes, and somebody out in the country has got a couple coyotes for sale, does this make this illegal for the Como Park Zoo or the Minnesota Zoo to obtain coyotes?
Mr. Bogus.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, no, because we could authorize that. Although I'm not, I think that's in the. We've done some amending to this language in the other body, and I do think you are raising a point, as this is originally drafted. As I look on page 10, where it says a person may not remove a live coyote from the site where taken, and may not possess, transport, buy, or sell a live coyote at any time. That's pretty absolute. We do have some other ideas.
Except as authorized by commissioner or something like that. We can think about this as we move forward in the process.
Okay.
And address any pitfalls.
I think Mr. Knopf's looking up the statute as well. Mr. Bogus, why don't we have you walk along with the bill here, and we can come back to this.
We'll hit this one again as we go through. So Section 9 is a technical change. Currently, law says we have to deliver a summary of the hunting and fishing laws to county auditors, who used to be the primary managers of license agents. Now the department does that, so we've just changed county auditors to say license vendors, sufficient to furnish a copy to each person obtaining a license. Section 10 relates to waterfowl feeding and resting areas. These are areas that are kind of refuges in the fall where motor use is prohibited or restricted. In some cases, electric motors can be used on those. They're either no motors at all or only electric motors. Under current law, it says those electric motors have to be less than 30 pounds thrust. That's kind of an outdated measure of the power of an electric motor, and there aren't very many electric trolling motors that are even made that are that small anymore. So we just like to change the less than 30 pounds thrust to with a battery power of 12 volts or less. There are a number of systems for electric trolling motors, 24 volt, 36 volt, 48 volt, you know, and on up. And so we would just, and this would be an easy standard to measure in the field. Section 11 relates to WMA use protections. This is a portion of provision that we had discussed last year. It's also now in the policy bill, Senate File 1110, and it would exempt WMAs that meet certain size standards from local ordinances that prohibit discharge of firearms or trapping or things like that. So Part A would say that any WMA that's 160 contiguous acres or larger is exempt from those types of ordinances. B is any that are at least 40 but less than 160 would be exempt from ordinances that restrict trapping, discharge of archery equipment, discharge of shotguns with basically the smaller shot, restrict noise, require leashes on dogs. And this is something that we've discussed with both a work group of stakeholders that the department had assembled and also with representatives of local governments, and it's been non-controversial. Section 12 is a technical change related to take a kid fishing weekends. current law says a person over age 18 can fish without a license on those weekends if accompanied by someone under the age of 16. It kind of leaves the 17-year-olds in limbo. So we just want to change it to if you're over 16, you can fish without a license as long as you're with someone that's under 16. Section 13 is angling in a state park. As drafted in the bill, you can angle in a state park without a license if you're accompanied by a child under age 16. We've actually been working on trying to expand that to allow basically anyone in a state park to angle without a license as long as they're fishing from shore on state-owned land within the boundaries of the park. Or if they're floating a boat or floating in an inner tube or something, then they could only do it if they're on a water body that's fully contained within that state park. And the idea here, and some other states have tried this, is to try to encourage people in those parks to try angling with the hope that they'll want to fish more when they're maybe not in a state park and they will become a licensed buyer at some point. Section 14 actually is repealing a change that passed last year. Essentially, that's what it's doing, is repealing a change that passed last year that had an effective date of March 1st of this year that required residents under the age of 16 to obtain a free small game license. Currently, if you're under age 16, you can hunt small game, but you don't need a license. The intent of the change that was done last year was so that we would know how many kids under 16 are small game hunting, but we're concerned that it could have an unintended consequence of becoming a barrier to kids participating, because now if they didn't get to the ELS or wherever and get the license, then they couldn't go without some pre-planning or perhaps having to go into town or whatever. So we're just we would like to know more about that under 16 population, but we don't want to create a barrier in order to find out that information. Section 15 is just a technical change from last year that non-residents 18 or over can take deer by archery for that fee. It was just a couple of words were left out in the drafting of the final bill. Section 16 relates to a technical change on shelters. Right now that we have fees for fish or dark houses. Those aren't well defined, and if it's a shelter that's on the ice and someone isn't fishing or spearing in it, then we can't necessarily say that it's a fish or dark house. It may be a warming shelter or whatever. So we'd just like to make sure that any shelter that's left on the ice that's not portable, which is covered in a later section of the bill, would fall under this licensing requirement. So we'll hit this one again actually in section 17 and then again later in section 24.
Mr. Boggess, are we in danger of making this shelter thing so complicated that nobody ever really knows where they're supposed to fall? I get a lot of calls, or when I speak to outdoors groups, they ask me questions about the shelter rules, and I really don't have good answers for them.
Mr. Chair, it's a good question because, you know, kind of by definition, any shelter is portable. We don't have any that are left out there permanently.
Minnesota.
So, but, you know, maybe if you'd like to look at Section 24 of the bill on lines 10.7 to 10.15, I think this is where I'm not saying it's necessarily, you know, not still confusing, but it's the ones that need to be licensed are the ones that are left unattended on the ice at any time between midnight and 1 hour before sunrise. So as long as they're not leaving them out between midnight and 1 hour before sunrise, they don't need a license. But if they leave them out during that time, they need a license. I mean, I think that's the simple answer to the question.
But if they pull them down the road to get them there, then they need the trailer license.
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, the trailer license is new, and that is another complication to this. They didn't used to have a trailer license. That's not a DNR requirement, Mr. Chairman.
I understand, but I don't know. It just seems like it's getting bogged down.
The change in this bill is just to say that if it's a shelter left on the ice, it doesn't have to be fish house, dark house. It's just some sort of a shelter that's left during those hours. And that's all we're trying to do, and hopefully that will help make things cleaner. Section 18 is the same issue that we started on with the fees for the aquaculture licensing. This is just the private fish hatcheries in the 97C. The previous one was the aquatic farms in Chapter 17. Section 19 relates to shipping wild animals by common carrier. This is like shipping you know, small game or deer or bear or fish or whatever, packed in dry ice. We used to have two different standards for residents and non-residents. Actually, in current law, it's a little bit more liberal for non-residents than it is for residents. The primary change here is to make it clear that they don't have to ship. A resident doesn't have to ship them to themselves. They can ship them to a taxidermist, a tanner, a fur buyer. But we're also combining the resident and the non-resident provisions so that they're the same for both. So at the end of the bill, you'll see a repealer of the non-resident provision, and this will just cover any person shipping by common carrier and make it clear that they can be shipped to a taxidermist, tanner, or fur buyer.
Mr. Boggess, is common carrier assumed, or do we have that in definition someplace?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware if common carrier is a defined term in the game and fish laws.
Mr. Chair, it is a...
Senator Schottner.
It is a term of art in law, common carrier. It's basically plane, truck, train, some sort of commercial car.
Okay.
That's what it's commonly, that's what it's, that's the legal term of art, common carrier.
Okay. Mr. Boggess.
Moving on to section 20, our intent with this section was to make it clear that if you were muzzleloader hunting, you couldn't have a high-powered rifle with you, centerfire rifle with you. During that season, as we've been going through the process in the other body, we've identified some issues with how this is worded, and we don't have good resolution for how to accomplish our original intent without creating some other problems. So we may be, as we're working with the author and the committee finalizing the bill, I think we may be just asking to take this piece out for this year. So, but that was the intent of this section, was to just make it clear that during the muzzleloader season, you can't have a high-powered rifle. The problem that's creating is that the language that's being stricken on 8.31 to 8.34 was passed in the mid-90s to allow people to predator hunt as long as they weren't muzzleloader hunting. And this fix kind of undoes that change that was done about 10 or 12 years ago. And we don't have a good way to accommodate both at this time, so... We'll think about it some more, but we may be just asking to skip that for this year. Section 21 is technical related. Current law prohibits night vision goggle equipment, but there's a lot of other night vision equipment out there now, cameras and binoculars and things like that. So it would just prohibit any type of night vision equipment while taking wild animals or possessing implements that could be used to take wild animals. Section 22, we did a report to the legislature on looking at barriers to disability hunting, and one of the things that was identified in that report was that sometimes participants in sponsored hunts don't have the permit to shoot from a stationary motor vehicle. And we just, for those types of hunts that are permitted hunts and sponsored by an organization, we would like the authority by rule to authorize the shooting from the stationary motor vehicle, whether or not they have the permit under 97B055 subdivision 3.
Mr. Boggess, if I could take you back to line 917 and 918 on the night vision stuff, why are we deleting this peace officer's provision there?
Mr. Chair, Colonel Conrad is here from our enforcement division. I think the answer to that is that we believe this is redundant language and they already have that authority.
Colonel Conrad, did you want to speak to that, or did you? Was that an adequate explanation? Thank you. Mr. Knopf is just curious where that might under where. Colonel Conrad, we may need to hear from you yet. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Chief Jim Conrad, Division of Enforcement. I guess I won't be able to avoid speaking to the committee. I don't know exactly where that is, but there was also another issue that was brought up in addition to that it was redundant that peace officers were allowed to do that, and that was that there have been complaints in the past where law enforcement officers operating out of their squad cars have been found to shine deer. There's one or two cases in the past 20 years where that happened, and I think this was also meant to address that, to not give them that exemption.
Mr. Knopf?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you also have the military personnel. I assume that when they're operating at night, I'm not sure that they're – I don't know how this – if you don't have this exception, it looks like this law would apply to them because they're going to be in possession of a firearm, bow, or other implement that can be used to take wild animals.
Mr. Conrad, it does say while exercising their duties, yes. So they we're assuming that they're doing their work.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with you on that, and it was recommended that we remove that because there was a authority already in another chapter, and I think it would might have been 169, but not sure. So I would have to research that.
Okay. Appreciate that. Mr. Bogus?
Okay, moving to section 23 brings us back to the protected mammals and birds and the coyote provision. And I think on this, I think it does need a little bit more work, as we talked about before, on and as Senator Chaudhry had suggested, authorized by the commissioner. And we also, I know, have been looking at maybe not disrupting the activities that are going on within the state that we actually weren't aware of when we drafted this, and but dealing with the importation and exportation provisions. We have some language that could address both of those that we can bring to the committee.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bogus, another thought I've had here is that you may have some soft-hearted folks that may come across an injured coyote or maybe injure them themselves with a motor vehicle and decide to transport the coyote to a veterinary clinic for care. And I think there is a facility here in the city that specializes in taking care of wildlife that's been injured. And so I think we need to take that into consideration, too. If somebody wants to assume financial responsibility for the veterinary care of an injured coyote, they ought to be able to do that.
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, we do have a number of licensed wildlife rehabilitators around the state, and there is a large facility here associated with the university that does that work. You're correct. So it's a good point. We'll look at some language that would make that sort of an exception for transport for licensed wildlife rehabilitation facility or something like that, I think makes sense.
Mr. Bogus, section 24.
This is the shelter issue again that we talked about already. And then section 25 is a proposal by the department to increase the statewide minimum size for muskie to 48 inches. Currently it's 40 inches by statute. We would accept lakes that are listed in paragraph 2 in the metro area counties there where we're managing for tiger muskies, which is a musk-lunge northern pike hybrid that doesn't get as big, and maintain the 40-inch minimum there. This is all drafted for rulemaking with with a good cause exemption authority on lines 11.14 to 11.16 because we do length limits by rules for other species, and so this would, and we can use this good cause exemption to amend permanent rules without going through the full-blown process. It only takes about 3 months to do this good cause process, as long as the direction from the legislature is clear and no interpretation is required, and it's approved by an administrative law judge. And this provision is also in Senate File 1110. So that's, and there's, I would just say on this that, you know, we've talked about it at roundtables. We've gotten a lot of public input on it. There's strong support from the Muskie organizations. There, you know, isn't unanimous support from everybody. There are some people that would still like to be able to keep that one big fish that they happen to catch, but it's, we have a world-class muskie fishery in Minnesota. It's a destination for a lot of people from around the country, and actually some other jurisdictions have even higher minimum sizes than the 48. We think this will continue to improve our muskie program and populations, and it's generally well supported. The repealers relate to the provisions on common carriers that we talked about being combined with the resident. The muskie size limit in statutes being repealed because this would put it into rule. And the free small game license for youth is being repealed. That's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Senator Parasol?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Baugus, I'm not sure if you and I spoke of it, but I think Mr. Meyer and I spoke about this. On page 4, section 9, which is the section about the summary of fish and game laws, the Trappers Association said they don't really need to be part of the big package, but that if you post the things that are related to trapping online, they will be happy to download them themselves and print their own, so they could have it on a single sheet of some kind or whatever amount of paper it would take. I'm not sure if you care to publish it in another form, but they don't need to have the entire synopsis, apparently.
Mr. Baugus,
so they
comment?
Asked me more than once to offer that change.
Mr. Chair, Senator
if
Parasol,
the department is amenable to
Senator
it.
Senator Parasol, would the association be willing to write a letter to the committee indicating that?
Well, how long do you want to wait for it? Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. How long would you want to wait for it? They asked me about it before we started session, and I did talk to somebody in department about it, and they thought it could probably be accommodated, but I'm not certain how amenable they are to
well,
it.
Well, I think we just... if we
Mr. Baugus could give us that clue.
Yeah, if the Trappers Association could just let us know in writing that that is their desire, that way we can explain...
How about I have them call you?
That's fine. Yeah.
Or I'll have them call Mr. Baugus or whoever wants to have the call.
Senator Parasol, just, you know, to give a little bit of history, we used to have separate little pamphlets for deer and waterfowl, and we still do for waterfowl trapping and so forth. And, you know, the other thing we could do, I'm not sure how it's downloadable right now. We do have the whole regulations book on the DNR internet site, and it can be downloaded and printed. I think it can be done by section, but if not, we could certainly set it up so that that trapping section could be downloaded and printed. It would save a few pages in the book, and we're looking for ways to save printing costs. The other thing is, though, that we do like to at least have a page or so for each type of hunting or trapping opportunity that's out there, just so that people that aren't familiar with it will know that it even exists. The Trappers Association members are very familiar, but for someone just the first time hunting or trapping, we'd still like something in there that would direct them to where they could get more information.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
it would be helpful then that they could actually get caught up on something if it's published separately in any way, even if it's online, if it's just separately.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think what Senator Parasol was talking about was eliminating it from the whole, but was the idea that whether they could access it in an individual piece rather than having to carry around the whole book or whatever. But I think that you've got the answer there. If you can program your printing out of that online so that they could take the applicable segment, that would save paper, and they might not need the whole book, so you might save overall printing costs if people can do it flexibly.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And last year, Mr. Bogus, I brought this up as well. Online, page 4414, just a point of interest. I get responses from some of the licensed vendors that the state of Minnesota is sending out way too many of these copies. And I see it in statute that one copy per each license. I'm sure that's what you're doing. Just a point of interest. Are you hearing? What can I respond to this person? He's very concerned that we're wasting money. And,
Mr. Bogus,
I don't want to see us waste money, but I also want to see us to be informed as well. So.
Mr. Bogus, I'm one of those who, when I buy my license, I don't take the regulations with me.
Mr. Chair, and
that's right. Senator Mr. Bogus, I don't want to know.
Ignorance is bliss.
Mr. Chair, that's because you never had to worry about a limit either. But.
Mr. Bogus, do you hear that from other vendors?
Mr. Chair, I have to say I really haven't heard it very much, but we are trying to follow the law that there's a sufficient supply to provide one copy to each person purchasing a license. And as you know, that requires that we print more than, the number of people purchasing licenses because the distribution isn't always uniform on where people go. So, for example, I think, we have somewhere just under 600,000 individuals who hunt in Minnesota, and I think we print about 800,000 of the books.
I notice where I buy mine, if I come back later and buy some ammunition, for example, they'll just slip one in the bag on the way out, so you get it one way or the other. But Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, is there some way that you could identify that if you've gotten it when you buy one license, you don't have to get another one when you buy a second license?
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I think we just try to have a sufficient supply there at the counter that a person that wants one gets one. I do think that this law is very old and predates the Internet and all of that, and I think it is a valid point that maybe we should revisit this law or revisit how we provide this. Maybe it should be one copy of a summary of how you can obtain the regulations or something like that, or, we could send written copies or give them the websites or whatever, but, it's right now we're held to the standard of making sure there's an adequate supply that anybody that buys a license can get a copy if they want it.
Senator Pariseau, to this point?
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, Mr. Bogus, especially now since we have instituted, I forget how many, if it was 1 or 2 years ago, we instituted the mandatory training for trappers, and the association does it on a regular basis annually. And so they do have a lot of young people who are going to go out for the very first time that they train. And it would be helpful for them to have a simple piece that wouldn't necessitate them.
It's not 100 pages.
You wouldn't have to do the whole book for them. So you could just, if it could be available to them, they'd be happy to print it out themselves in their training period. So.
Other questions? Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, Mr. Bogus. I'd like to talk about Section 14 on page 6. Seems to me that could be worded a little more clearly without changing the effect of what you want to do. And what I would suggest is on page 6, line 3, delete this whole phrase, may not obtain a small game license, but, so I would just read, a resident under age 16 may take small game by firearms or bow and arrow without a license.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson,
Senator Chaudhry.
I think that probably helps the intent of the section. Yeah, I think we need to talk about this section because we need to decide as a policy committee whether we want information on youth licenses, small game hunters. This will streamline one's ability to hunt, meaning you'll take out the step of having to go get the license even though it's free. But if we are thinking in this body about increasing youth numbers in the outdoors, particularly hunting, it would be a valuable tool to be able to track those numbers closely and accurately. Now, yeah, there's other ways, surveys, et cetera, but as long as we're doing it now and there's a culture of obtaining a license, at least for the purposes of being able to know how many kids are hunting, wouldn't this be a valuable thing to retain? That's a question for us to discuss. And remember, the license is free. The question here is just whether you need to go get it or not.
Senator Fredrickson, follow-up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, has this gone into effect already, or is this going to...
I forget what we did last year. Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, it took effect March 1st. So they now are required to get a license to hunt small game, but, of course, you know, the seasons aren't open until the fall. So effectively, it has not yet gone into effect. It will this fall.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogason.
Senator Frazier.
Has this change been incorporated into firearm safety classes? We're anticipating they would need to get a license? And how valuable is this information to the department? I agree with Senator Chaudhry. It would be good information to have, but if it's an impediment to some young people taking up hunting, I think we need to question the value of it.
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, it would be good information to have, and we would like to have it. We're just, as I said earlier, we're just concerned that there's never been a lower age limit on when you could hunt small game. It's a parental decision, and they've always been able to go whenever their guardian or relative or friend wanted to take them. And we're just concerned that, you know, if now there's suddenly an opportunity to go out with someone, but they haven't been to the local sporting goods store or convenience store to get their license, they'll just decide to do something else instead of that. And so that's the only concern that we have.
Why don't we ask the department to see if there's some more information on the actual, how this has actually been a barrier, if they've got information that this has actually been a barrier, if their kids are, this really is a problem. And I agree, if it truly is a barrier, let's get rid of it. But it's providing valuable information to efforts to get more kids into the outdoors, and so we should just approach it carefully.
We need to move along, members. Senator Olson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, is there any record kept of young people getting the firearms safety certificate or any of these other certificates? I would think would a lot of them,
the instructors,
if they're taking the
department too.
Could you make some assumptions that they're probably taking that for a reason and will use it?
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, yes, we do keep records of firearm safety, and that is, we do think that's an index to hunting, but they don't need that for hunting until they reach age 12, so we still don't know age 12. We don't have a very good idea below age 12.
Any others feel the need to weigh in on this?
We got to move on to the other bills.
Senator Chaudhry, what do you want to lay this?
Yeah, we'll lay this over.
Lay this over. Senator Dibble.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I apologize. I've been kind of presenting bills in other committees. Did we discuss on page 5, section 11, the exemption from local ordinances for WMAs?
Yes, we did.
We did? Okay. Is that a good idea? Have local units weighed in on this?
They're fine with it.
Okay.
So the provision also passed the state and local government committee as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Phoebe's witnesses need to leave. I apologize, Senator Senjum. We told you you'd be up pretty quick, but I would like to take Senator Phoebe's bill first. Next.
Are far away too, probably.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. It's tough. Senate File 1656.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for hearing this Senate file today, number 1656. I have to start by saying, in my short time here at the Capitol, there's been a lot of people get passionate about things, and two things that I've had to work on predominantly most of my time are Green Acres and minnows, and both quite passionate topics. So Green Acres, we've kind of tucked away a little bit, or we've worked on that a lot, and now we're moving on to minnows.
We have an author's amendment.
I do have an author's amendment that I'd like to move, the A1 amendment.
On the A1, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Yes, it's been passed out.
I do have a number of people here to testify.
Make sure you get it. And it is an author's amendment. It's putting the bill in the shape the author desires. Does Senator Olson have?
Not that I can see.
Let's get that out. The amendment is adopted, but let's get that out before we start.
Especially when it's a deleter.
Talking about it. It's a delete all. There was a drafting error. The substance of the language is essentially the same. It's just it's put in the subsequent subdivision instead of in subdivision 4, and that helps the intent of the bill. Okay, Senator Phoebe.
Upon taking my post here, right away I started hearing about a shiner issue or a minnow issue up on southern end of Lake Mille Lacs. From a lot of my bait dealers up there. Got a number of calls, a number of emails. They were, waiting for me when I got here. And it seemed to be a supply and demand issue, so I started kind of working with it and exploring it a little bit, and I felt like I wanted to try to bring something forward. Maybe it's because I'm really new and don't know enough, but I'm here bringing this forward today so we can at least get the conversation going and get the bill on the table to look at it. So I'd like to just let my people that came to testify share their story with regard to this issue, and then we'll hear from others. So first we're going to hear from Tony Zenz, who's the owner of Prince Bait and Marine. You all drive by it on 169 up north of Malacca.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Tony Zenz. Like Senator said, I am from Malacca, Minnesota. In the last few years, we've really experienced a minnow shortage. Been tough on our small business. This is a family-run business. We have 8 employees. We pride ourselves in a small-run business, the traditional bait shop atmosphere. Try to know people by their first name when they come through our door. Go the extra mile when we can. Treat people like we like to be treated. And in running a small business like this, we kind of get to the brunt of the public. We answer to the public daily. Not knowing what we're going to have for bait week to week makes it tough. Ordering the bait today isn't like it used to be, just back to not knowing what we're going to get. It's hard to tell the public or people that you don't know what you'll have for the weekend for the next delivery. Turning people away. You know, it's a lot different than anything else we need to order in our shop. We order bait, tackle, whatever. If I run out of Coke or Pepsi, I need pop, make a phone call, the cooler's full the next day. You know, same with lures. You run out of a certain lure, make a phone call, it's there tomorrow. Minnows, on the other hand, I order 20 gallons of one type, 60 gallons of another type. Truck shows up. Not sure what I'm going to end up with. Well, we got half what you wanted or way less than half. This winter was no exception, worse than the last few years. Put a bad economy on top of that. Things weren't good. We'd have people calling from the metro daily looking for minnows. Nothing left in the metro area. We have a few left. We'll stop by and pick those up. If you just imagine running a gas station and people have been calling all week. We're looking for fuel. There's not much down here in the metro. Things are really looking good. We got fuel, and must be a huge weekend coming up. We're going to see some new faces. Business is going to be good. About Thursday, your tanks are looking empty. Some pumps have run out of gas. Get on the phone to your distributor. They send up transport. Right away, the truck shows up, and they have less than a quarter of what you ordered. Now you're in for a bad weekend. Well, we're sorry. That's all we had. The wells in Minnesota have dried up and haven't produced. I know this is different than minnows, but the inconsistency and not knowing what we're going to have for inventory makes it very tough week to week. I'm not a biologist, don't know everything about that. I do understand the need for rules and regulations to bring minnows into our state. We hope that you would allow the dealers and wholesalers that are willing to jump through the hoops, and they need the chance to get the certified clean bait from other states, let them do that. That's their job, and the public demands it. I wanted to hand these to Senator Bobby. You know, this is a list from two weekends. There's customers coming in when they asked for minnows. We didn't have it. Sign your name here. There's people from all across the state. You know, not just a central Minnesota issue. This is people driving all over to get here to get minnows. We've seen people come up from southern Minnesota, other states south of Minnesota, still needing minnows by the time they got up to us. You know, we're middle of the state, and they haven't found minnows driving that far up. They all want the same thing, just couldn't find them down there. And there's been a lot of changes in our industry, and everybody, you know, the times have changed a lot. We used to trap all of our own bait. We no longer do that. We buy all of our own bait. You know, so for me to give someone an answer, it's out of my control. I buy from someone higher up than me. It gets to my door, and then I distribute it. Like I said, we try to maintain the small shop, traditional bait shop, the mom-and-pop shop. You know, small resorts, they've dropped like flies over the years. You know, I'm sure you remember going up north to your cabin or on a fishing trip with family and friends, swinging by one of these small shops or resorts. There's not a lot of these left. It's kind of the going up north experience or tradition. You know, you take a kid into a bait shop or anything, the first thing they're drawn to is the minnows. You watch their faces light up when they see them. The minnows are a huge part that keeps our business unique and different from everyone else that's out there. You know, without the bait, we may as well give up. We've got Walmarts and Cabela's, big chain stores, and they don't cater to this type of business. This is what we need. We need a steady, consistent supply of minnows and help us survive. And that's all I'm asking for, and thank you.
Thank you. Senator Frederickson, you have a question for the witness?
Mr. Chairman, I do. Mr. Zins, do you ever import minnows into the state from species that have been published in the USDA Inspection Service that are susceptible to septicemia?
We don't do any importing. We buy all ours through another wholesaler, someone higher up on the food chain than us.
Mr. Zins, do you know if any of those species that you do get from the wholesaler are on this USDA list?
That I couldn't say. Some of those folks are here today, and they'll be able to answer that question for you. They'll be testifying shortly.
I think our next witness will be able to speak a little bit more detail on that. Okay. Next witness.
And Mr. Chair, can I say one more thing?
Yes,
there was a flyer like this in your folders. It goes about, you know, just saying we had some public meetings up around the Mille Lacs Lake area. Some of the answers we received from biologists around the lake, that we do not expect the shortage of golden shiners to last longer than 2 years. I'm not sure how you can state something like that without the facts to back it up. You know, there's a lot of different outside effects that can cause these shortages, and there's really nothing that supports that the shiner shortage is going to quit or get better. We need these minnows now, but
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zents. Appreciate you being here. Mr. Oswell.
Mr. Chair,
to the committee.
Members of the committee, my name is Greg Oswald. I'm from Ellendale, Minnesota. I am a wholesaler. I wholesale into 14 different states. I am owner of Oswald Fisheries, Inc., Trophy Game Fish, and Prairie Waxworms. I'm on the National Aquaculture Association board. I'm on the steering member, a committee member for VHS. We've traveled to a lot of states and listened to a lot of testimony. I'm also on the North Central NICRAC committee. I'd like to address the issue in regards to other states' handling of these issues coming up for importation that Minnesota will be confronted with. I would like to start with Minnesota and Maine are the only two states with outright ban on minnow importation. The exception is in Maine, they do allow importation of the Arkansas Golden Shiner. APHIS, USDA, knows of no negative health incident with importing health-certified bait in any state using a responsible certification paperwork and tracking that system. I'd like to just briefly, instead of take up too much time, I'm sure this will be coming up again, but an example of how importation paper works is a certified individual, a veterinarian, AFS certified person, they can come out to your pond, to your shed, to your lake, whatever is deemed necessary, and collect these fish for the state that is accepting them. He is the collector, keeps a chain of custody where it would go to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Lab, University of Minnesota, or several private labs around the country. Then there's a 28-day waiting period where these fish are tested for whatever viral, bacterial, other substances they are looking for. The state, each individual state has different requirements. They are tested, kept. Then the lab generates health paperwork for that requesting state. The original copies are kept then in our offices, and a photocopy or additional copies, if we need what we call originals, have to go. That follows that load of fish. It is date sensitive. It has pounds or gallons issued to that paperwork. And it's very trackable and has been tracked in certain instances.
Mr. Oswald, which labs are used in general?
Myself, I use the University of Minnesota currently. I have used a lab in Maine prior, but that expense gets to be very expensive in the shipping.
So is the University of Minnesota a common lab that's used for this?
They have the ability to do this, to do the testing correctly, as the DNR. The DNR at times is overwhelmed with the testing they must do for the state's fish and the state's hatcheries. But they're qualified to do anything that would be required done.
Okay. Senator Saxon?
Excuse me.
I might just ask this question now. Is Mr. Oswald?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Minnesota is the only state that doesn't allow minnows from the outside to be sold as bait?
The only one that I know of. Maine will not allow this northern minnow into that state.
Do you have any opinion as to why that is?
Mr. Oswald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had discussions with
the history of that, Senator Saxog, is that in the 60s, the bait producers were interested in an importation ban to limit competition. And the way it has turned out in the last 4 years, they have the leadership, the industry has changed their mind, and particularly with the growing seasons in Minnesota and the shortages that have resulted, and want us to revisit that policy.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Oswald, but in all due respect, Mr. Chair, a lot of this, I think, has to do with having 10,000 lakes and a great fishery. Mm-hmm. And, and I used to do a lot of fishing in Wisconsin before the Minnesota opener and have been witness to what really lousy minnows look like. And I've always been proud. Actually, we used to take our own bait to Wisconsin because it was so good. But I think that I'm concerned about a bait coming in from the outside and being sold in Minnesota because I'm worried about exotic species more than I am about septimia or anything like that. And I think we should take a little bit of a chapter from our friends up in Ontario. who basically don't let us bring live bait in. You know, there's got to be a reason for that, isn't it? I don't think it's just the bait dealers, but...
Well, we'll keep talking about that. Yeah. We will certainly hear from the DNR. Mr. Oswald, did you have more you wanted to add?
Mr. Chair, committee, I would like to address that further. When I'm in agreeance what he said, it was about a Protection Act years ago, but at the same time, for many years, South Dakota, North Dakota couldn't bring bait here, but we could go there and get that bait. And then there was rule change later on, and now it has been more than the four, but the last 4 years has been a real stressful period about all through all these discussion meetings. But at the same token, by putting our head in the sand and becoming so territorial, there is no question that there is a lot of bait coming from contiguous states illegally, particularly in this shiner market, right from our Wisconsin border, and is being done today. We have no check and balance on that issue. Another major problem with this, and this will be in conclusion, I won't take up a lot of time. Another major problem that I see in the current statewide shortage, other than just the minnow shortage and the shiner non-existent, would be that if we would, God forbid, find VHS, which is one of the primary diseases we're looking for in the Mississippi River, Lake Superior, our laws are set up where bait harvest will be non-existent in this state. You will have no bait. With importation regs already in place, this would allow the industry to continue to supply a health-certified bait for the state anglers. It'll help keep tourism healthy and going. I believe that there are these other states have just as significant interest in the quality of health-certified baits as Minnesota. I also would like to add, last year, I did the feed contracts, 63,000 gallon total that didn't come out of Minnesota, to Texas, Wisconsin, Michigan, New York, Iowa. Those people have very stringent regulations. They are quite sure this invasive species you speak of, including plant and weeds, particularly out of how Arkansas uses their program, it's an aquatic nuisance species surveillance, and it started the day those farms, state-certified farms, asked for an application. That comes with the Department of Ag and a plant board. That's done twice a year. Their viruses, it has a two-year surveillance prior to them being certified. I think that certifications give us a stronger security coming into this state than what is transpiring now. Thank you, guys. If you have any questions, I will be here.
Next witness.
Okay. Hi. My name is Ron Mavison, or Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ron Mavison, and I own Ken's Bait Service. We started our business. My dad started it in 1950. We're a wholesale bait company. We sell bait to bait stores. I supply about 150 bait stores in the metro area. We've been doing it a long time, and we've seen a lot of problems come and go. The shiner thing has been a problem that's been getting worse every year for the last 20 years. I got two guys that raise shiners for me that are probably the biggest shiner raisers in the state. One of them gives me all of his shiners. The other one gives me about two-thirds. We had enough shiner to take care of these 150 bait stores till about Christmas. And the rest of the winter, they were out. These stores are all struggling with the economy. Even without the economy, they're struggling, and they're fighting to stay open. I feel bad we can't give them the bait. I mean, they could be making a lot of money if they would have this bait. It was a prime winter. We have no product to sell them. I support this bill. I think the bait could be brought in free of disease, and everything could be done right. I think these bait stores could thrive. I think Minnesota, I think it's a fishing state. I think people come from all over the United States to fish here. I think that people live here because it's a fishing state. And I want to see the bait stores make it, and I want to see tourism grow, and I want to stay in business. I think the DNR will give you numbers of shiners that are raised in the state. I think that number is off. And the reason I think it's off is when we apply for a license, we have to tell them how many shiners we sold. That's what they want to know. Well, when I buy them from Ben's bait, he gives me the shiners. He sends a report in saying how many shiners he sold. Then he gives them to me, and I have to say how many shiners I sold. If I give some of them to Greg, Greg again says how many he sold. Well, 500 gallons of shiners could actually look like 1,500 to somebody that was making out this total collection. I think other benefits of the bill could be if there was a VHS outbreak in a state and they stopped us from selling our minnows, we could be able to bring minnows in from other states that were disease-free and be able to still take care of these stores and keep everything going. We'd have a constant supply of bait. These stores could thrive and do good.
Senator Phoebe, I'm reading the bill. Your bill is not allowing for import of minnows, because under the subdivision, current law allows the import of minnows. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. The problem is that the minnows that are imported now can only be used for DNR's hatcheries and resale out of state.
For exporting or for feeding their
for
hatcheries.
The DNR.
Correct.
Okay. So the DNR is using these minnows that are imported for itself. Some of them.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. All right. All right. So this is not you're not allowing a new import of minnows. We already allow imports of minnows.
We already allow imports of minnows, is my understanding, and we're just asking that some of those minnows that currently are being imported be used available for bait.
Okay. All right. Senator Saxon.
And so currently, Mr. Chair, if I could ask the testifiers, those amount of minnows that are being imported right now, how many are in our 10,000 lakes? I mean, we can resale them out of state. We can use them in our rearing ponds.
They are not sold as, Mr. Chair, committee, they are not sold as bait fish currently. They are brought into our trophy game fish. The DNR brings these fish in and feed to their, or have the ability to bring them in and feed to their prodigy to grow them up. And then the prodigy goes into lakes all over. So if there would be disease involved, that would go into those baby walleyes, muskies, et cetera, and be spread all over the state.
Follow up, and then Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I'm not quite as thinking quite as exotically as talking about those diseases. I'm just talking about the exotic species. I mean, I realize that we certainly don't want to have, I can't even pronounce these diseases very well, but I'm only worried about sicklebacks and, you know, heaven knows what, you know, what comes in from other states.
Mr. Chairman, committee, sticklebacks are here. You are not going to introduce any more sticklebacks to Minnesota. I do not believe that. And there are not sticklebacks in say, the shiner states of Arkansas. Those ponds are drained. I don't think the heat, et cetera, we don't see those coming out of that state.
But there, regardless, there is a certification and a quarantine and a certification recertification on all those imported minnows anyway. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Senator Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand the language in the bill. There's a shortage of bait available to the bait shops, and yet you're talking about importing minnows and that 20% may be sold for bait, but 80% must be sold. They're for export. You import them to export it. Could you help me understand that first sentence? 80% of the minnows imported under the subdivision must be for export outside of the state.
Senator Olson, that refers to, and probably should be in the bill, but we're not changing that section. Subdivision 4 of that's the same section talks about the, well, maybe Mr. Knopf can
can talk about that, but currently it's only allowed for, import is only allowed for export or use in our hatcheries, state hatcheries. And so what this bill is doing is opening the door a little bit for some of those that are certified and not on VHS list to be sold in-state as bait.
And Mr. Chairman, just to add to that, if you see Senator Olson on line 1.7, currently under these special permits, all of the minnows that are imported have to be for export. So what this does then is say that only 80% of those have to be for export rather than 100%. And then 20% can be sold as bait. It does, as Senator Chaudhry said, it opens the door a little bit, but not for all of the minnows that are imported.
Senator Olson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I haven't been involved with this enough to understand why you would say you can only import them to export them. What, because you didn't want any of those minnows entering any of our lakes. Is that the point?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's current law.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Did you have any other witnesses, Senator Phoebe?
I believe that's it for now. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, DNR? And for some of the members who have not been, or the new members especially, or new members of the committee, we've dealt with the aquaculture issue in the past couple years over the impact of aquaculture on our wetlands. And finally last year we imposed some restrictions on the aquaculture industry and wetlands that were pretty strict and were accepted by the aquaculture industry nonetheless because of their understanding of some of the issues. It was after a lot of debate. We had a study. We had a DNR report. We came back. We debated more. And we finally ended up with some restrictions on aquaculture in our wetlands, public waters. Those were pretty strict restrictions even without the bait shortage. And so what Senator Phoebe's bill is trying to do is balance what we've done in the past for the environment in a rational way to at least allow some bait that's already imported and certified and no chance of getting VHS to be sold to Minnesota sportsmen. Mr. Johannes, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mr. Chairman and committee, my name is Roy Johannes, and currently my role is aquaculture consultant for the Department of Natural Resources in the Division of Fish and Wildlife. Just a few clarifications before I begin my introduction to some of the concerns that we have as a department. First of all, the current language allows two types of importation for minnows. Actually, there's four types of importations that are allowed.
Current law.
Current law, okay. Correctly. The first one allows minnows to pass through the state, and there's a permit that our conservation officers issue at the border, and it's a 12-hour permit that allows minnows to pass through the state. The second type of permit is allowed is for the import for processing of bait for sale in a processed condition. And process in the aquaculture laws means a change of state, which allows it to be either in a preserved or frozen manner. The third type of permit that is allowed is for the import of minnows for feeding hatchery fish. And this primarily is dealt with contiguous states where fish farmers in their state import minnows to feed their game fish. Primarily fathead minnows are allowed for import on that. And those particular approvals are only allowed in waters that do not have any inlets or outlets and have the lowest risk of any escape into Minnesota waters. The fourth one, where the delete all amendment is proposed, deals with the import of minnows for later export. And if you look at Part C of that particular current law, it has a lot of stipulations and conditions on that. And because of the fact that we have allowed a few of our fish farmers to go to Arkansas to import golden shiners for later export, we have some really strict conditions on those. Currently, we only allow permits to be issued to those that have buildings with no exit, no effluent to public waters, or for excavated ponds that do not have effluents to public water. So you can see we have very, very controlled method even for the import for later export. Again, we're very concerned about the new language that's being proposed because of the it increases the risk of the introduction of fish diseases, parasites, and invasive species in Minnesota. We already have a great amount of invasive species that we deal with currently. As I talked about the current permits, these are very, very restrictive in nature, and we're very concerned even about issuing some of the permits, and I'll go into some information that I'm going to share to explain why. The first thing that I have is a handout dealing with South Dakota. And as you'll notice, there are some darkened counties on there where the Eurasian rud has been introduced with mix-up from golden shiners. And to look at how this can be really expanded is, if you look at this little county way on the one side of the map, in 1997, there were nine ponds in that county that were found to contain the Eurasian rud. In 2009, you can see how through introduction and importation of bait, how this particular species has spread out through the state through importations. If you look at other things that are now found in that handout that I have, South Dakota does now have bighead and silverhead carp, which are bordering very close to the Minnesota border. The life history of these individual carp can be mixed in and can be confused and misidentified in loads of fish. The third one deals with the grass carp, another prohibited species in Minnesota, which is very close to the Minnesota border. The next document that I want you to look at is a document regarding the import of the rud into Canada as a mix-up for golden shiners. And this particular article identifies that it did come through the bait buckets, that once bait is brought into Minnesota and goes through bait shops, the avenues for getting out to lakes and streams statewide is very quick. And if you look at the key notes of this, this does have an impact on game fish species in the state, and in a very early life stage can be confused as a golden shiner. And if you look at the color picture, many of you who do angle notice that this could be confused as a golden shiner. So with those kind of key pieces of information, we're very concerned about the risk. Now, again, you can see it that I did reach some fame by the article that was passed around earlier in your packet about discussions about the bait shortage. We were very concerned at the DNR about those shortages and had taken some steps to try and move some bait into the Mille Lacs area late in season. I realized that our efforts were probably too late for the time to deal with the issues that were arising during the mid part of winter. However, we did have some success doing that. The other thing that we did find out is that late in the season, there were a number of dealers that did have golden shiners available for sale and could have moved some in, but it was too late in the season. We feel that the industry is in Minnesota is available to increase its methods and improvement for golden shiners. If, as was discussed in the reports that are required by the DNR, the last few years we changed our reporting process at the request of the bait industry. Mr. Mavison said that our previous records included only bait that was sold, resold, and over again. If he filled out his reports the last 2 years, he would have known that it would only include bait that was harvested and bait that was sold, so that we can separate those two things, because we were concerned about them with discussions that we had 2 years ago. So with that, you know, we're very concerned that about the bait shortages in Minnesota. We feel our industry, and in talking to industry people around the state, they feel that they can gear up. One of the big shortages that we did have this year, which was not available in numbers too, was what a bait we call the Northern Red-Bellied Dace. And this is a bait that would have filled in the niche for the golden shiners, but was also in short supply because of our growing season last year. We feel that in going into 2009, that we will be able to bring in some of these species like the northern red-bellied dace and the red-tailed chub, or also known as the horny-head chub, in numbers. With the winter that we've had this year, we feel that we'll have a number of clean ponds available for our dealers to restore the bait practices that they could have had in the past years. With that, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Mr. Johannes, if the DNR is concerned about invasive species, European rut and others from South Dakota, why does it import bait from contiguous states like South Dakota for its own hatcheries?
Mr. Chairman, the DNR does not import any minnows for our hatcheries for feeding game fish. We purchase any minnows that we need from local bait shops. And primarily in our trout hatcheries, we used artificial feeds. And in our rearing ponds for walleye, we use the natural feeds that are found there, primarily invertebrates and minnows.
So the DNR currently does not import, purchase bait that has been imported from contiguous states for purposes of its hatcheries?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, so the subdivision 4 of this section of statute is obsolete?
No, Mr. Chairman. What's section 4 of that chapter allows is for game fish farmers to import bait for feeding their hatchery fish as part of their program. We do purchase fish from some of those hatcheries as part of our program of fishing restoration and stocking in the state.
If the DNR is concerned about invasives from those contiguous states, why does it purchase those fish that have been fed with those types of bait from those contiguous states?
Mr. Chairman, that's an easy answer. First of all, we only allow the import for those ponds that do not have any inlets and outlets for escape into public waters. Okay. As part of our program of purchasing private walleye fingerlings for our stocking program, we have a very rigorous inspection process where we're running fish through graders to look for and to identify any undesirable fish as part of that program. We many times we have hand counting going on, and we also inspect each load that is being transported around the state. When that load is also being delivered to the lake where fish are going to be stocked, we have another individual that's monitoring the operations, checking the loads again to ensure that we have the quality and the specific species that we need for stocking in our state.
And Mr. Johannes, do you, for importation for later export, does the DNR often put reasonable restrictions per subpart C on containment, certification, and disposal to ensure native species are protected?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we do. And in the case of the permits that we do issue on import for later export, we ask to have disease certification if they're bringing golden shiners in from Arkansas, and that includes that for Asian tapeworm and for golden shiner virus. And for other restrictions that we have, we include that if they're using artificial ponds, that there are no effluents to public water.
Okay. Senator Phoebe, does your bill propose anything different?
Not that I understand.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, could we work out some transfer of your fastidious approach to protection from the invasive species over to the aquatic vegetation so that we don't get that moving around the state? I mean, I'm impressed with how thorough that you are in examining that, and we don't have that kind of you're trying, but it's not there. But maybe some of that kind of vigor and commitment into the aquatic vegetation would help us.
Mr.
Was
Chair,
that rhetorical.
Well,
Senator Olson,
it's a compliment.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson.
But also expression of a need.
Senator Olson, I think you could if you wouldn't let the boats move from lake to lake, but. We're not going to do that.
No. Mr. Chairman, I have not asked for that.
Further discussion, we should probably get on to Senator St. John's bill. Okay, Senator Phoebe, just a brief summary.
Just wanting to know if anyone briefly is here interested in testifying, either for...
We took testimony in favor. The DNR is concerned. Does anyone else want to testify against the bill? If not, Senate file 1656 will be laid over for further consideration.
Okay.
Thank you very much,
thank
Senator
you.
Phoebe. Senator St. John, thank you for your patience.
Yes, go ahead.
Senate file 1502. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Pleasure to be here, and I appreciate your willingness to take this bill up. The committee has heard this bill before, and at least other years, last year, I believe. It has to do with shining, and the idea here, I suspect, or at least from my perspective, I'm here on behalf of the big bucks and maybe trying to level the playing field a little bit. Mr. Chair, this bill gets at a prohibition of shining. It's obviously largely directed at deer, but it's written in a fashion that would address other game as well. That prohibition is not exclusive, however. There are a number of exemptions that we put into the bill, which I think will allow life to go on and for people to certainly not only do normal things, for instance, in their fields, in the woods with lights that are necessary and permissive. But at the same time...
For members' purposes, the Senate hasn't seen fit in the past to pass this proposal. We usually run into trouble in conference committee. We've discussed this issue quite a bit, and Mr. Senator St. John is bringing this forward again. Perhaps in the interest of time, we could talk about if you say whatever you want, of course,
right.
But if you're interested, maybe you could concentrate on the differences from last year or previous years of this
proposal.
You know
what? I'm going to turn either to Mr. Stubstead from Rochester, a Bluffland whitetail person, also owns an archery shop, or Gary Bostick. They have worked over the interim with DNR and others to frame up some differences here. So either one of you can...
Mr. Stubstead, you've traveled a ways. We appreciate your patience here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Martin Stubstead, Director of Board of Directors on the Bluffland Whitetails Association, also archery retailer for 32 years. Compared to last year's changes, yes, we did make some significant changes that were concerns. The biggest one was the retrieval of dead or wounded big game animals, which we made as an exception in the bill this year, where it hasn't really been a problem in the past, but it was felt necessary to apply it in the bill. So under subdivision 3, under exceptions, an additional exception has been proposed to allow the retrieval of dead or wounded big game animals for 2 hours past sunset using artificial light while on foot. This will protect hunters from incidental violating previous subdivisions of this law. Also, again, being the third year that this bill has been introduced, the amount of support is actually getting to be quite overwhelming. We've got the Minnesota Bow Hunters Incorporated on board now with, of course, the Bluffland Whitetails Association. We also have the MDHA chapter out of Winona Bluff Country Hunters Association in favor of this, and the Minnesota State Archery Association is also very much in favor of this. I've got one thing to pass on from a landowner I talked to yesterday, that you're all cordially invited to his place come this fall to sit on his porch to watch the harassment of the shining, of what's happening in the fall. And that's where I don't think we made enough direction last year, that the landowner, if we could poll the landowners of Minnesota that have enough wildlife on their property to be concerned with this, I can guarantee you that they would pass this bill unanimously because of the harassment. We also totally believe that a lot of access for hunters have been denied because of the shining law, because of the amount of recreational shining that is out there. And again, because of the vast amount of shining recreation that is out there is one of the biggest problems we have as far as our conservation officers being able to get to the actual criminal because of the of having maybe from anywhere from 10 to 20 complaints in an evening, which one do they go after? By eliminating it to this 1 to 2 hours after sunset gives plenty of time for the recreational shining for a father, son, or whatever, or a mentor to take the the person out to actually to shine. We've talked about this a tremendous amount. I don't think we have possibly any possible more room for exceptions in this law. The conservation officers of Minnesota are demanding this. We're hearing this from and many of the we had over 60 years of experience of conservation officers on this committee that has written this bill to be hopefully to be passed. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? Mr. Botzik?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Gary Botzik for the Minnesota Conservation Federation. We, too, have been involved in this process now for 3 years. I've got two resolutions that came to us through my sportsman's clubs, particularly Lewiston Sportsman's Club, and their concerns were 2006 were based on farm lot shining artificial light that's going on to farmsteads, homesteads, animal lots, both cattle, horses, etc. This isn't just not a shining, we went from shiners to shining here, but we're talking about artificial light that's being used improperly. And one of the other changes that we made, Mr. Chairman, from last year's bill that did get all the way to conference committee, if you see on the very last section three, we asked for and received with DNR's enforcement suggestion or agreement to not make it a penalty the first year, but rather a teaching experience so that there be no citations written. Section three of the bill is a temporary warning, a one-year reprieve. So use it as a learning process or a learning curve so that no one would see it creeping up on them, Mr. Chair. We support it, and we hope to get back to conference committee, Mr. Chairman. And I'll give up my seat to Captain Conrad, who helped us facilitate this and did such a great job that he got a promotion out of it. So he can relate to some of the very technical changes here. There's some recodification going on here, so some of the exceptions are being moved and brought into a different section. And Greg Knopf, counsel here, helped us write it, so he can help us with any of the technical questions. But we urge your support and look forward to working with you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Botzik? Mr. Conrad.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Chief Conrad, Division of Enforcement. As the previous witness told you, I facilitated a meeting between the various different user groups who were approaching us with the request to help them construct a law that would appeal to all the parties involved. The process was long and arduous. We did not have complete buy-in from all groups. However, this was the consensus resolution that came out of those meetings. I have to reiterate that this is not a DNR bill, but rather is sponsored by the Bluffalands groups and other interested parties. But we did help facilitate the crafting of this. Many of the issues that our officers are finding out in the field include a lot of time spent chasing down complaints, and with the current regulations that allow shining up until 10 p.m. as long as you are not in possession of a firearm, it basically allows for the violator who intends to check out the area to go out and see if the conservation officers are active. They go out without a firearm to begin with and shine around, and if a conservation officer responds to that complaint, they know we're out there. If nobody does, maybe at that time they go back and get the firearm and consider that area safe for further activity. Also, they are experiencing a lot of complaints from agricultural landowners and residential people, especially in the southeast part of the state and up in the central part of the state, the Little Falls area, Camp Ripley area, up in that direction, where they're complaining about the lights constantly going up and down their roadways, shining onto their property, disturbing their livestock, and also shining into the windows of their residences at all hours of the night where this activity is occurring.
People have wildlife in their houses?
Mr. Chair, wildlife on their property.
Okay.
In particular, we have
maybe there's a wild life going on in the houses, but not wild. Senator Parasol?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask anybody at the table to describe to me what on page 3, sub 2, what would that be defining other than all the other things that are in these several pages? I've been glancing through it, but that one kind of stumps me. What would that be? Carry out outdoor recreation is defined in Section 97B, not related to spotting, locating, or taking. What might that be?
Line which line?
Lines 332 and 333. Can't visualize what sort of circumstance that might be.
Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Parasol, it's meant to be a broad definition. If somebody is out snowmobiling or in a boat or doing any other activities that are kind of outdoor recreation that aren't involved, where you're not involved in the taking them, it was kind of to make sure that those people wouldn't get tripped up into this and be technically in violation of the shining law by doing some of the activities. Like if you're in a boat and you're shining to find your cabin, you're shining a light up, that you wouldn't be in violation. Or if you're on a snowmobile trying to find your shining light, trying to find a location, wanted to make sure that there was a broad,
I'll get caught in.
And that is a broad definition of outdoor recreation. It means any voluntary activity, including hunting, fishing, trapping, boating, hiking, camping, basically anything that you're doing for outdoor recreation purposes.
It is under the non-violation section, but I was just kind of
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chief. Section 3 that Mr. Botsik explained something new there. I'm certainly in favor of that. How are you going to keep record of that? If that same person gets caught the next night, how do you know that you may not have a third or fourth violator there? Are your records that good, that current?
Captain
Mr.
Conrad.
Chair, Senator, no, they aren't that up to date. They are entered as quick as we can get that warning that was written into the mail to St. Paul and then entered by a... Our officers still utilize the mail and entered by a data entry person. So those records are not kept up to date daily. But the way that I read this, it wouldn't matter how many times they violated that first year. It would be a warning each time.
For the first year. All right. Senator Saxog, and then we should probably take some...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, not anecdotally, but the Chief, we know that most of the wardens know exactly who's getting the violations and who's getting the tickets, so most of them remember what's going on.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. They have a tendency to remember the individuals in their particular area. It's when they start crossing lines of patrol districts that sometimes it would get a little muddy.
Would anyone like to testify in opposition to the bill? Mr. Kelleher? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. And in the shortness of time, which I think is about where we're at, I'll talk as fast as the committee can follow, I suppose. Mr. Chairman, I believe I delivered to your office earlier in the session. We had 7 corporate board resolutions offered by our individual chapters at our corporate board meeting in February. This issue was one of them. I'll just read it. It's very short. Therefore, be it resolved that MDHA seek to amend existing laws to completely eliminate recreational shining of deer from any and all public thoroughfares. That was the version of the resolution that came from our particular chapter down in the third zone 3. That resolution failed 90 to 181. As I've said before, we have about 60 chapters, but depending on the members and size of the chapters, it's a weighted voting system. So for all intents and purposes, I think we still oppose Senate File 1502. I went upstairs earlier and pulled Senate File 3057, which is the version from last year. I can't tell a great deal of difference between the two, but I'm not Mr. Knopf and others. And I have two major concerns with the way the bill is drafted, three actually. First of all, is this is a statewide application. It applies statewide to all areas of the state. We did not have before our corporate board a resolution to limit this application to just Zone 3. So if that's what the committee was going to do, I'd have to go back and check to see if that's okay for the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. That is something that I talked to Mr. Botzik about, but I haven't seen an amendment to do so. And specifically to the bill, on page 3, line 3.27, one of the exemptions, well, 3.26, one of the exemptions that allows for cast the rays of a, let's go up to 3.24, cast the rays of a handheld artificial light to retrieve wounded or dead big game animals, provided that the person is on foot and not in possession of a firearm or bow. That means you'd have to dispose of your firearm or your bow before you could retrieve your game, meaning you walk back from your stand to either your vehicle or your deer shack or wherever you started from, leave that firearm or bow, and then go back and try to pick up that blood trail at night in dark. Current law allows you to do that, I believe, with a cased and unloaded weapon. Also, I think last year during the conference committee, one of the things that, and this is very confusing to read, everybody knows it's even hard for me, and we testified in the conference committee last year that the other thing that this, we believe, would prohibit, and I, Mr. Knopf can correct me if I'm wrong, would not allow us to walk out before sunrise with artificial light, with our firearms, bow, to our deer stand. So we would have to wait until it's bright enough to walk on the trails to get to our deer stand before we could go out. And Mr. Knopf can correct me if I'm wrong on that. I think in the shortness of time, that's
so three, just three, my testimony. 3.27 is a real sticky point, 3.27.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Knopf,
as I understand the current law, you're basically in violation when you do those things now. And this was to make sure that there was an exception in place to allow that. The way I understand the current law, because if you look at subdivision one, and the current law, when you have a gun in your possession, you're basically prohibited from shining. And it doesn't matter the time of day.
Mr. Chairman, just real fast. On page one, what's being deleted is 1.21 and 1.22. It says this subdivision does not apply to a firearm that is unloaded, and on the next page, in a gun case expressly made to contain a firearm. So,
Mr. Chairman, you missed one. Number three, and in a closed trunk of a motor vehicle. All three conditions have to apply.
Okay, we'll take a look at that. Fair points, Mr. Kelleher.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Okay. Last words, Mr. Stubstead.
Yes, thank you. You were thank you, Mr. Chairman. You were given a map of Minnesota counties, and one of the things that was said about the shining is that it was only a enforcement came up with these stats on summons and warrants to show you the number of violations were directed or given and the different counties were leading actually southeastern Minnesota. Thank you.
Members, staff has requested that we put our materials back in our folder before leaving, and then we will reconvene. We will recess and reconvene at 6:30. And Senator Dill, did you have a final comment?
Well, Mr. Chair, just looking at this thing, and I don't know why you'd want to go looking around in the woods for a wounded deer unless you had some method of killing it when you finally get to it.
That's right.
So does that mean you're supposed to bring your tomahawk with and hope it's disabled enough so you can get to it?
That's an implement.
If you find a deer that's down and it, you know, you're looking for it and it's still alive, you know, in the interest of humane treatment and ethical hunting, you do want to shoot it.
Catch it.
Well, it says you can't have your gun with.
Right.
Well, that's what the point that Mr. Kelleher raised.
We need to fix it.
And we apparently can't do it anyway now, so maybe we need to revisit that. So thank you, Senator Senjum. This bill will be laid over for further consideration. And the committee is in recess until 6:30 p.m.
Mr. Chairman, we're not dealing with House bills that have met deadline. We seem to be all dealing with Senate.